and wide astray. Ah, shut in narrow, doleful form, creeping in reptile flesh upon the bosom of the ground. The eye of man, a little narrow orb, closed up and dark, scarcely beholding the great light, conversing with the void. The ear, a little shell, in small volutions, shutting out all melody, and comprehending only discord and harmony. The tongue, a little moisture fills, a little food it cloys, a little sound it utters, and its cries are faintly heard. Then brings forth moral virtue, the cruel virgin, Babylon. Can such an eye judge of the stars, or, looking through its tubes, measure the sunny rays that point their spears upon Udanadan? Can such an ear, filled with the vapors of the yawning pit, judge of the true melodious harp touched by a hand divine? Can such closed nostrils feel a joy, or judge of autumn fruits when grapes and figs burst their coverings to the joyful air? Can such a tongue boast of the living waters and take in aught but the vegetable ratio and loathe the faint delight? Can such gross lips perceive? Alas, folded within themselves, they touch not aught, but pallid turn and tremble at every wind. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, this is that program, the Ask Dr. Hal Show, live on radio. Yes, dear fiends, this is your irritating horror host, Dr. Howland Owl. And tonight, we venture to sail forth through magic casements onto perilous seas in fairy lands forlorn. We are all under an enormous stressor, the impending doom rushing our way. As Larry Garnick said, it's like a hurricane is coming at you and you are powerless to stop it. But we will see what the next weeks bring forth. Even our subterranean realms will be affected by the outcome. And we will discuss other plagues that have afflicted the earth, not only those sent by the Ancient of Days in his later dominion, but those which have accreted. Eternity is in love with the productions of time, and time brings everything to light. In particular, we may discuss the vampire and the varieties, the distinguishing features and functions. The human mind has always circled about knowledge of these things, but has never attained it. However, through access to special and recondite sources, we may grow closer to the understanding of this and other phenomena here under the aegis of the Church of the Subgenius. What is the aegis? It was the banner of Athena, Minerva to the Romans, and that outfit included the hideous severed head of the Gorgon Medusa, most famous of the Gorgon sisters. All who beheld it are struck to stone. And therefore, endure in a die eternity, perhaps. The place of images. The closets and lumber rooms of the noosphere containing the perfect forms of our imagination. For I have seen the lost city of Irem, city of pillars, otherwise called the city in the desert, in a lost land that only dreams have known, where flaming suns walk naked and alone among horizons bright as molten brass. And glowing heavens like furnaces of glass, it rears with dome and tower manifold, rich as a dawn of amaranth and gold, or gorgeous as the phoenix born of fire and soaring from an opalescent pyre sheer to the zenith. Like some anadem of titan jewels turned to flame in dream, the city crowns the far horizon light over the flowered meads of Damascene, a desert isle of madrepearl, wherein the thurifer and opal-fruited palm and heaven-thronging minarets become the seas of azure wind. How doth the little crocodile improve his shining tail, and pour the waters of the Nile on every golden scale? How cheerfully he seems to grin, how polished are his claws, who welcomes little fishes in with gently smiling jaws. The 41st Ask Dr. Hal show, the home edition, has been completed and is archived and posted. Now, almost immediately, we must begin working on number 42, because the vagaries of the calendar cause it to fall earlier in November than it did in October. Yet we will promise some surprises, even at this early date of collation and creation. For after all, there is a certain familiarity with a long practiced routine, something which has been done over and over, again and again. And we have the records of the past to call on, other shows in other venues, in other states, in locations far from here, and yet as near as this show, which we will now proceed to demonstrate, going to the recent Starwood, where the subgenius revival took place in the Puffer Dome, a great white egg-like structure, not precisely a building. It is inflated by air pressure, and one must go through an airlock to come in and out. But how perfect it is for some productions, not just mine. Upon its curving surface, projections may be flung to accompany what is said and done, as it was then.
The very stuff of life does not conform easily to schedule, fit within the lines, occupy the exact instant it has been allotted by the schedule.
the buzzing, the beeping, all because of poor sound recording. A quality which we are not able to control. We are the ones being recorded. But perhaps we will be able to become used to this spotty transmission.
That change happened invisibly, unremarked on, already some time ago. And so, in order to appease this impressive mass of gadgetry, we must delay for a short time the beginning of our presentation.
Yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Subgenius Revival at Starwood. And now, as is only fitting and proper, permit me to bring on the man of the hour, the founder of the Church of the Subgenius itself, the sacred scribe, Reverend Ivan Stagg. He's in the peak of health.
He just needs to clear his throat.
Ready to go like
here,
a
spit it out, Stagg.
I know the Subgenius is for what they was, and I know J.R. Bob Dobbs for what he was. And my
still going strong at 114.
I died when I had a heart attack 3 years ago. And what you're watching is
like Igor,
shadow.
But he lived on after his death. Like Igor.
Best. Because, God damn it, we're at Starwood. And it's a beautiful
Starwood.
Thing. It's such a wonderful, slack-filled,
wonderful Starwood.
Of disjointed beliefs.
We're back at Starwood once again.
Oh, the first time I came here, I thought they invited me to speak because I thought that it was an ambush. Because I was fairly, my main gig was making fun of and making sport of all this woo-woo and spiritual stuff and paranormal.
As we say in the church, believe me out of it.
For 10 years, because I consider it the most important thing in the world. Were it real. As it turns out, I'm now a natural philosopher, a junior scientist, clown, and a servant of J.R. Bob Dobbs. That man.
Praise Bob.
Now, how many here can say praise Bob in a heartfelt way? Just say, praise Bob! Okay, well, everybody knows how to say it. That's good.
Okay, you got a good reading there. That was an enthusiastic praise, Bob. The machinery is going crazy.
Join the church with your little simple tithe. Of, what is it now? It's $35.
How fun, how ingenuous. He pretends not to know the price of the Subgenius membership package.
But, by golly, slack has not changed.
Slack
has not devaluated. In fact, it has become more valuable than it ever was before. It's being taken from us.
Whoa.
In more grotesquely obvious ways than ever before. And yet, it's like we kind of go, oh, this is just part of the show, right? It's not really... We're not really losing our...
Why do they demand this reassurance?
We are the real world above and beyond the wonderful visions of the Church of the Subgenius is more fucked up than ever. And our response, of course, is rather than fight the conspiracy with conspiracy tools, is to wait for X day and get real high and watch TV and just wait for X day. How many X days are we going to wait through? We just did our 24th X day.
Hooray!
24 years of standing out there in that stone circle going, okay, it's 7 a.m., 1998, July 5th, come on, saucers. Oh, well, they didn't show up. And then we just go back to our cheesy apartments and get high and watch Netflix or whatnot. I've done maybe read a few sci-fi books. Maybe a few people here actually read stuff, period. But
some of us get to go to things like Pube Fest, where we saw a cow fall through the air and land with a tremendous crash. A cow fell from a great height and landed with a thud in the pasture. We were all there.
Perhaps a man, perhaps something more than a man, perhaps a meme.
There was a splintering crash of wood and the front end of a cow protruded through the side of the upper floor of the barn.
That's all there is to it. That's all you need to know. This is a face.
There it is. And it fell.
Based on that one face. That one face. That's all you really need, because if you truly focus on that and forget all the other bullshit, your own personal slack will rise bubbling to the surface like it's been trying to do for so long. And many of you have already freed that slack. You're living it. I'm sure though there's some that are going, oh, well, I don't know. I probably like to have some. I think I know what they mean by slack. I just don't know, because I keep thinking about my worries. And to tell the truth, I'm the same way. All I can think about is my dogs.
Oh.
To leave our two dogs for a whole week. That's the longest I've been apart from those children. It's going to be 2 weeks. It's affected my digestion. But I have faith that all these swinging wild festivals will be over, and my idea of slack will return. Which is actually really pretty humble. I used to think, well, man, if only we were as big as South Park, we'd really have slack. Oh, gosh, if we were like Monty Python, a respectable comedy fake cult, that would be better. But no, all I really want to do is go back to that nice ranch in Texas and a high ground and hills.
Scrub off this slack.
And continue to fill orders for Subgenius membership packs, which we have a few left, which we didn't bring here. But when I do the big divide. Well, anyway, friends, that's all a bunch of hooey. The point is slack. We're here for slack. Starwood delivers slack in fast gallons, quantities. It washes over you. And then you get tics and sunburn and
ew,
a headache. And, you know, it all has to balance out.
But when the rain comes, the tics are not to be seen.
Anti-slack.
It rains heavily at this festival.
If you have that kind of zen, feeble-minded approach, like so many of us do, just the picking off the ticks can be slack. Just sweating and even being uncomfortable can be an odd form of slack for some people.
As long as you're deriving it from that.
Individuals here at this campground who obviously get slack by working their asses off in the hot sun and sweating like animals. Doing services for others, be they human or subgenius. So we can't define that. The whole goal of the church at subgenius, we could never define it. Slack. It's a slack for you is maybe totally different than slack for me. I actually kind of derive slack from working. But at the work I wanted to do, wouldn't it be great to be paid to do what you want to do? Man, what a dream that is. Why is that a dream? Why isn't that a reality? Well, because of the conspiracy.
Right, the conspiracy will not allow you to realize your dream.
The conspiracy, that means the Republicans. Oh, no, that means the devil. No, that means the flat earth, the hollow earth, the underground demons.
And, the People's Front of Judea.
No, I'm afraid not, friends. The conspiracy is when it's too hot on the bus. It's that simple. It's when you're a little uncomfortable. When you're fed up.
That's me.
When you lose patience. And just get... If you just... If that good mood has gone away. The conspiracy, sure, it's the boss and the big corporations and the governments and all that. But it's also that voice inside your head that says, everything sucks and everybody's against me. Well, it might all suck, and they might actually be against you, but probably not. It might suck, but they're probably not all against you. They probably never even noticed you. So the slap comes from just accepting the fact that we're never, ever going to be perfect.
It drops from above.
Bob's dots.
Like the gentle rain from heaven.
Around, they never stay quite the same position. You stare at one of those heads long enough, you'll see what I mean. It starts getting expressions. It knows what you're thinking.
Winking.
Every one of them dots heads.
Gesticulating.
On bridge abundance.
Grotesquely.
Xerox.
Simpering and making faces, the Dobbs head burst into unthinkable life. The sculpted lips twisting back from the stem of the pipe in an unholy mockery of slack-filled laughter. For this is no true Dobbs head, but the audio animatronic creation predicted in the Bible, which will appear in the last days. The avatar of false slack. Incredible, incurable falseness. And what can it do? It's just an image. Haven't you heard of slack vampires? Yes, these are simply a form of the pernicious pest known as the vampire. In all the darkest pages of the malign supernatural, there is no more terrible tradition than that of the vampire. A pariah, even among demons, foul are his ravages. Gruesome and seemingly barbaric are the ancient and approved methods by which folk must rid themselves of this hideous pest. Even today, in certain quarters of the world, in remoter districts of Europe itself, Transylvania, Slavonia, the isles and mountains of Greece, the peasant will take the law into his own hands and utterly destroy the carrion, who, as it is yet firmly believed, at night will issue from his unhallowed grave to spread the infection of vampirism throughout the countryside. Ancient Assyria knew the vampire long ago, and he lurked amid the primeval forests of Mexico before Cortes came. He is feared by the Chinese, by the Indian, and the Malay alike, whilst Arabian story tells us again and again of the ghouls who haunt ill-omened sepulchres and lonely crossways to attack and devour the unhappy traveller. The tradition is worldwide and of dateless antiquity. Travelers and various writers upon several countries have dealt with these dark and perplexing problems. Sometimes in every case the discussion of the vampire has occupied a few paragraphs, a page or two, or at most a chapter of an extensive and divaricating study, where other circumstances and other legends claimed at least an equal, if not a more important and considerable place in the narrative. It may be argued, indeed, that the writers upon Greece have paid especial attention to this tradition, and that the vampire figures prominently in their works. This is true. But on the other hand, the treatise of Leone Alacci, De Graecorum Hodie Quorundam Opinationibus, printed first in 1645, is of considerable rarity and was difficult to collect. Nor are even such volumes as Father Francois Richard's Relation de ce qui s'est passé de la plus remarquable à Saint-Erénée, 1657. Or perhaps we could turn to the pages of the Voyage au Levant from 1705 of Paul Lucas, and Tournefort's Relation d'un Voyage du Levant, 1717, although perhaps not altogether uncommon and certainly fairly well known by repute, generally to be met with in every library which is in any way complete. Not the libraries of superficial people, but the library of the well-rounded autodidact, who dares indeed to look into the face which is one of unspeakable horror. The study of the modern Greek vampire in Mr. J.G. Lawson's Modern Greek Folklore and Ancient Greek Religion has, of course, taken its place as a classic, but says incidentally and in passing that Mr. Lawson will not touch upon the tradition in other countries and at other times, for this lies outside his purview. But as I have said before on this program, the latest piece of Roman writing from the classic period, the Metamorphosis of Lucius Apuleius, otherwise known as the Golden Ass, which contains many interesting things, including the complete first iteration of the legend of Cupid and Psyche, has a clear, how would you say, a clear instance of an encounter with two very deadly female vampires. And so the seeker after special studies must refute those who claim that there is no historical or legendary tradition. There is indeed, but it is not dwelt upon, thought even in the course of study, to be encouraging the worst aspects of existence and the most hideous physiognomy the universe projects toward us at certain stressful times. In classical Latin, the word lamia is described by Lewis and Short as a witch who was said to suck children's blood, a sorceress, enchantress. I doubt whether this is a very accurate definition, although possibly it will cover the meaning in Horace, Ars Poetica, which I will now quote. No quod cumque uelit poscat sibi fabula credi, nil pransae lamiae puerum unium extrahat aluo. That is to say, the probable maintain, nor force us to believe the monstrous scene, which shows a child by a fell witch devoured, dragged from her entrails, and to life restored. And it is in the Apuleius's Metamorphosis, the Golden Ass, that we read, Quo odore spurcissimi humoris, me lamiae illae inficerunt. Here the word lamia is hardly the equivalent of saying anything more than witch. As readers of the Metamorphosis know, after having sex with his girlfriend Fotis, who was also a witch, they decided to spy on their hostess, who was a more powerful witch, and watched her change herself into a great bird. And wanting to do the same thing, they got into the potions. But unfortunately, the hero, Lucius, found himself turning into a donkey. And thus his degrading adventures in the book began. So, the meaning of vampire had been to a large extent lost or submerged. This idea, however, seems to have remained in Aristophanes when, in The Wasps, Philocreon boasts what tales he can tell of things and women who drink blood and life. Liddell and Scott define lamia, or the Greek equivalent, as a fabulous monster said to feed on man's flesh, a bugbear to frighten children with. Well, I'm sure Mr. Liddell never did. His daughter was Alice Pleasance Liddell. That is to say, Alice from Alice in Wonderland, Alice's Adventures Underground. And everyone who studied Latin at Oxford used Liddell and Scott's special book. Tertullian, Adversos Valentinianos, which de Labriol dates at 208 to 211 Anno Domini, uses the phrase lamiae turres as nursery tales. By the way, I'm not going to go on with this Latin, but when I do quote it, I will not use anything but the classical pronunciation, which everyone tells me is wrong because everyone has not studied it and has probably been instructed by some down-at-the-heels Catholic priest pronouncing Latin in the medieval way, which was a magnificent tradition under St. Augustine, but has certainly fallen by the wayside, although it's there in the Vatican that they speak it when they have to. Dr. Abraham Van Helsing had a special papal dispensation to carry and dispense holy water in his fight against the undead. Toward the end of the 17th century, and even more particularly during the first half of the 18th century, when in Hungary, Moravia, and Galicia, there seemed to be a veritable epidemic of vampirism, the report of which was bruited far and wide, engaging the attention of curia and university, ecclesiastic and philosopher, scholar and man of letters, journalist and virtuoso in all lands. There appeared a large number of academic theses and tractates, the majority of which had been pre-selected at Leipzig, and these formally discussed and debated the question in well-nigh all its aspects, dividing, subdividing, inquiring, ratiocinating upon the most approved scholastic lines. Thus, we have the monographs of such professors as Philip Rohr, whose Dissertatio Historico-Philosophica De Masticatione Mortuorum was delivered at Leipzig on 16 August 1679 and issued the same year from the press of Michael Vogt, the Dissertatio De Vampirius Servientiusibus of Zopfius and Van Dalen, printed at Duisburg in 1733, and, not to leave out, the De Absolutione Mortuorum Excommunicatorum of Heineccius, published at Helmstad in 1709. I will pause and say this important monograph, De Masticatione Mortuorum in Tumulis, that is to say, of the dead observed chewing in their graves, was something that was read by H.P. Lovecraft when he was a youngster, which affected his worldview somewhat. And I could even quote from that disgusting piece of church writing. To summarize it, however, it is that a number of graves had been opened and found that the dead had been in there chewing their grave cloths and liniments. How terrible. It meant that some life seems to have persisted. Of course, others would say it meant that these unfortunates were buried alive, not embalmed, and woke up and in a frenzy devoured some of their own flesh and their own grave garments as they suffocated. But others would say that born into the secondary life of vampirism, they were developing sharpened teeth, which could even chew through cloth, flesh, wood, and the soil. As these revenants emerged from their disturbed graves. Yeah, you haven't lived until you've read De Masticatione Mortuorum. You see how that breaks down. Masticate is in there. Masticatione Mortuorum, that is genitive plural, of the dead. Mort meaning dead. From Leipzig, 16th of August, 1679. I was almost 30 years old that year. Anyway, there is also a production with practically the same name by Michael Ranft. That one is called De Masticatione Mortuorum in Tumulis Liber from Leipzig, 1728. Some consider it a reprint. I say the text is different and varies. Then there is the Dissertatio de Cadaveribus Sanguisugis from Jena, 1732, of John Christian Stock. How does that one break down? Dissertatio, clearly dissertation, de cadaveribus. Well, in Latin, the V and the U are the same letter. So instead of saying, as in the title, cadaveribus, how about cadaveribus? In other words, many corpses, many cadavers. Finally, the qualifying adjective, sanguisugis. Those who drink blood, in other words, who suck blood, blood being sanguine. These dissertations, however, are extremely scarce and hardly to be found, even if you make an effort to collect them, as I have over many, many years. While even so encyclopedic a bibliography as Cahiers does not include either Philip Rohr, Michael Ranft, author of De Masticatione Mortuorum, or Stock, all of whom should therein assuredly have found a place. In this connection, must not be omitted, the De Miraculis Mortuorum Leipzig Kirchner, 1670. Surely I don't have to translate that. And second edition, Weidmann, 1687, a treatise by Christian Friedrich Garmann, a noted physician who was born at Merseburg about 1640 and who practiced with great repute at Chemnitz. Garmann discusses many curious details and continued to amass so vast a collection of notes that after his death, there was published in 1709 at Dresden by Zimmermann a very much enlarged edition of this book. Extornatum Deo desideratum et expeditium beatu autoris obitu interruiniente. According to some legend, the binding of this book was later alleged to be human skin. Never saw it myself, but that seems about par for the course. During the 18th century, the tradition of the vampire was dealt with by two famous authors, of whom both concentrated upon this as their main theme. That is to say, by Dom Augustin Calme, OSB, in his Dissertation sur les apparitions des anges, des démons et des esprits et sur les revenants et vampires de Hongrie, de Bohème, de Moravie et de Silesie, printed in 1740 in Paris. This book was also in little H.P. Lovecraft's library, and he was quite familiar with it. Dom Augustin Calme. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, this book figures in his story The Picture in the House, which I recommend to my listeners. There was the Patriarch of Alexandria, one of the highest officials in the church, who wrote a vampire book called Dissertazione sopra I Vampiri, printed in Naples, 1774, never been translated into English. Of a later date, we find in French a few books such as the Histoire des Vampires, 1820, of the enormously prolific Colin de Plancy. Does the name Colin de Plancy have any familiarity? It should if you're a dabbler in the occult. And people who get into the occult get in by dabbling, which is a terrible way because then you know a little but not enough. You know enough to be hurt by it and not enough to succeed in controlling it. But aside from all that, Colin de Plancy is mostly known in the world of occultists as the compiler of the Dictionnaire Infernal, which has descriptions and pictures, very explicit pictures, of all the classes of demons, including the most famous ones whose names are known in the literature. Some of these are quite grotesque. For example, in my copy, what's the one that's sitting on the toilet? Beelphegor, the demon that has to do with everything foul and disgusting, and outhouses and sewage and pits and so on. This monstrous thing is shown sitting on an in the woodcut, sitting on an outhouse two-holer and lifting its tail out of the way so it can discharge its noxious excreta. As it says in the Necronomicon, as a foulness ye shall know him, as a foulness ye shall know them. Look it up. In English, there is a little book entitled Vampires and Vampirism by Mr. Dudley Wright, first published in 1914, second edition with additional matter in 1924. This book has the exact same title as a learned book on vampires by the ever-dependable Reverend Montague Summers, who has also written thick books on the subject of werewolves. And boy, is that one interesting. And witchcraft. Surprisingly enough, that one, being a survey and being highly opinionated, is not as interesting as you would think. But his book, Vampires and Vampirism, as I said, has the same title as the 1914 book by Mr. Dudley Wright, published in England in 1914 and then in 1924 in the second edition. It may, of course, be said that this is not intended to be more than a popular and trifling collection, and that one must not look for accuracy in research from the author of Roman Catholicism and Freemasonry. But, of course, the Church, meaning to say the Apostolic Holy Catholic Church, and that group known as the Freemasons are deeply entwined with the legendary lore and secret chronicles of vampirism. However that may be, it were not an easy task to find a more insipid oleo than Vampires and Vampirism, not Montague Summers, but the other one, of which the ingredients, so far as I am able to judge, are most palpably derived at second and even at third hand. Dom Calme, sometimes with and sometimes without acknowledgement, is frequently quoted and continually misunderstood. Dom Augustus Calme, as I just said a moment ago, was in the very curious library that young H.P. Lovecraft read as he grew up in the house which contained it and other recondite volumes. And it affected his views. Also, the famous illustration of the butcher shop of the cannibals, which shows a butcher shop with butchers' knives and tools and human parts hanging, is referenced in the picture and the house. And it is certainly also referenced in a short story, which some think is one of Lovecraft's greatest, and possibly his greatest, story of all time, The Rats in the Walls. Haven't I read that at one point here on the show? Perhaps it's time to read it again, particularly as Halloween looms closer. But I'm also thinking of a quotation by Günter Grass, which I can't quote properly, but it goes something like this. You ask why you were born in a city of evils and among twisted minds and intelligences. It is because your beloved ancestors, in secrecy and silence, committed horrendous crimes, and now you must pay the hideous price. Well, you get the idea. We are told in Dom Calme's book of a shepherd, a simple, humble shepherd. And are there any other kinds? Who lived near Kadam in Bohemia, in the village of Blow, and the relation is said to be taken from Deschartes, which would be Father Charles Ferdinand Deschartes, in his Magia Posthuma, that is to say, posthumous, or after-death magic, or philosophy, perhaps, Magia, published at Olmutz in 1706. And page 166, this story, as given by E.P. Evans in his interesting work on the criminal prosecution and capital punishment of animals, is told of a herdsman near the town of Kadan and dated 1337 A.D. Pages 60 and 62 which are stuck together with some mysterious substance in some editions, are occupied, once you pry them apart, with an oriental legend related by Fornari in his History of Sorcerers, by which is presumably intended the Histoire Curieuse et Pittoresque des Sorcières, Revue et Augmentée par Fornari, Paris, 1848, and other editions, a book usually catalogued under Giraldo, as by Cahiers and Yves Plessis, although the latter certainly has a cross-reference to Fornari. In fact, you could say you read one of these things, you've read them all, because the knowledge is distributed among them all. But if you read them all, you get little bits here and there which are not repeated in every edition. What is the philosophy of vampirism? However ghastly and macabre it may appear, one must not tamely shrink from a careful and detailed consideration of the many cognate passions and congruous circumstances which, there can be no reasonable doubt, have throughout the ages played no impertinent and no trivial but a very vital and very memorable part in consolidating the vampire legend and in perpetuating the vampire tradition among the darker and more secret mysteries of belief that prevail in the heart of human beings. I myself encountered at least one vampire, perhaps two, and survived. Thank you. Thank you very much. And then there's the werewolf. I mentioned the Reverend Summers' book on werewolves. In his book on vampires, this subject comes for review, since the werewolf and the vampire are closely linked, and in many countries there is thought to be a close connection between the vampire and the werewolf. And, anyway, Mr. Summers also wrote The Vampire in Europe, which lists many instances in complete detail. Moreover, he goes on to speak of the vampire in literature, and now we are in a more interesting realm, not depending upon what benighted ancient person told what horrendous story of a personal encounter, but using the craft and art of fiction, which should never be considered illegitimate, but rather superior as a method of disseminating knowledge and understanding. That's what biblical fundamentalists don't understand. That the annals in their holy book are stories which arose from sleep. They told their comrades and to sleep returned. Yes, a story can demonstrate something far more than a related instance. And as for the absolute primacy and holiness of this, if you are a Christian or even tend toward being a follower of the White Christ, then you have to remember that this person who everyone calls Jesus of Nazareth, well, he came from there, often told stories. And they said, "Master, why do you tell us all these stories? Was there really a guy who built his house on sand and so on? This sounds like something that's just a story." And he said, "Only by putting this in the form of stories can I get you knuckleheads to understand it." I'm parsing his words here. It wasn't quite that. One good thing about Summers' work is it has an extensive bibliography. You can look up these books, and if you're missing any of them, you can begin your lengthy search for them. In addition, he has an index which enables you to find citations, for example, of the Metamorphosis of Apuleius, which I mentioned before. But he goes very deep into the subject. Throughout the whole vast shadowy world of ghosts and demons, there is no figure so terrible, so figure so dreaded and abhorred, yet dight with such fearful fascination as the vampire, who is himself neither ghost nor demon, but yet who partakes the dark natures and possesses the mysterious and terrible quantities of both. Around the vampire have clustered the most somber superstitions, for he is a thing which belongs to no world at all. He is not a demon, though some people say he is, for the devils have a purely spiritual nature. They are beings without any body. Does account with a certain percentage of vampires, too. You see, they leave their resting places only as psychic essences. If they ingest blood at all, it is to put on the appearance of flesh so that they can be seen and encountered, so that they will have a reflection in the mirror, so that they can pretend to be people again, which they never, ever will. As St. Matthew said in chapter 25, verse 41, the devil and his angels. And although St. Gregory writes of the word angel, nomen est officii non naturae, that is, the name is not natural but is official, the designation is that of an office, not of a nature. It is clear that all angels were in the beginning created good in order to act as the divine messengers, and that afterwards the fallen angels lapsed from their original state. When Satan was cast out of heaven, struck by Saint Michael, and forced over the precipice of heaven to fall into the pit of hell, their eternal domain.
You've heard me do it before. How he was thrown out of heaven, sparking and spitting, falling, zapping, burning, with hideous ruin and combustion down to bottomless perdition, there to dwell in adamantine chains and penal fire, who durst defy the omnipotent to arms. 9 times the space that measures day from night to mortal men, he and his horrid crew lay vanquished, roiling in the fiery gulf, confounded though immortal. But his doom reserved him more to wrath, for now the thought both of lost happiness and lasting pain torments him. Round he throws his baleful eyes that witnessed huge affliction and dismay, mixed with obdurate pride and steadfast hate. But of course, as we know, he got out. He got out of hell, and he got into our world. And so our world directly communicates with hell. But he can't get into outer space, past the orbit of the moon. If he tries, he will find arrayed against himself, rank upon rank, the armies of unalterable law, who stand eternally on guard. And it was Uriel, not Michael, who gave